good to go.
All right, so we're going to start. I'm not happy with a microphone, but I'll do it. For you, I'll do it. Okay, so we'll try to do this as interactive as possible. I haven't practiced the lecture. Normally I practice when I give lectures, so you'll be as surprised as I will. So, Mike, you just hit page down? Yeah. So what I'd like to do is, I really, soft tissue infections is a huge topic. And rather than, I went over some etiologies with you, I try to go over syndromes with you so that you could recognize things. Because I think, and then I try to, even though it's not a board's review, I actually try to go over some things that I actually think will be asked on the boards. So if a patient like this came to you and said that they had a rash and it looked like this, how would you describe that rash? This is actually a sort of classic something about it that you might describe. Yeah, honey crust. Excellent. So what does the honey crust on that lesion tell you? Somebody said it in the front row? Impetigo, right. Impetigo. Excellent. And so impetigo is caused by what? Staph. So it used to be that impetigo, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit. At one point, I'm just going to go over all of group A strep with you because I think it's important that you see all the manifestations of group A strep. It used to be, when I was a resident, that group A strep was the most common cause of impetigo. But over the past 10 years or so, Staph aureus is actually leading. And so you can see that it's initially fascicular, later it's crusted, superficial infection of the skin. It's very common for it to be itchy, and so patients actually will spread it. It's painless, and as we heard, someone said that it was honey. It's this golden yellow, and it really tells you that it's either staph or strep. Used to be group A, as I just said, but the epi is changing, and staph aureus is now more common. It's different M proteins than on the normal group A strep, and so one can get a glomerulonephritis if it is secondary to group A strep, and that's an important thing for you to know as a clinician, but you don't get the cardiac manifestations of group A strep, the post-sequela. And so, you know, the way one treats it is you can either give oral or you can give topical. And I think for this, it's pretty self-explanatory. We look at either group A, we either target group A strep or we target staph. And so so this patient comes to you and has a cluster of lesions after being in a whirlpool, a hot whirlpool. So what do you think it is? It's a classic story. Good, it's a folliculitis caused by Pseudomonas. Excellent. And so you need to know that for your boards because they will ask you it. And believe it or not, it's, I have to tell you, you know that story about the medical student, you know that classic boards question about the medical student goes camping, drinks from a fresh stream, and comes back with diarrhea, and you always know it's Giardia. And so all of you know I see a lot of Giardia. You never see patients like that. You actually do see patients that go into whirlpools and come out with infections like this. And so it is Pseudomonas. Actually, the majority of cases of folliculitis are normally staph. So this is basically a infection around the hair follicle, and we saw that it's an erythematous peritic papule, often topped by a central pustule. Staph aureus is actually more common than Pseudomonas, but swimming pools and whirlpools have been associated with it. And if it doesn't get better with directed therapy towards either one, depending on the situation, you can get fungal infections and Malassezia furfur. Malassezia furfur is seen in those are cutaneous infections, but in the you should know that you can get bacteremias with Malassezia furfur, although this is a soft tissue infection, but you can get Malassezia furfur in people that are getting TPN with very high lipids. So we see this a lot in our NICU cases. And so this is the picture of what one sees on the left. There's a healthy hair follicle, and on the right, an infected hair follicle. And you can see why it's a raised erythematous papule that ultimately develops pus in it. And the treatment is normally topical and local measures. It's really hard because I can't see it on here and I can't see it on there, so sorry about that. So I'm just going to briefly go over a furuncle and a carbuncle just to get to one other issue with you. So a furuncle is a deep inflammatory nodule that develops from the preceding folliculitis, all right? And so anywhere where there's perspiration, hair follicles, and it normally begins as a firm, tender, red nodule, and it's normally painful, associated with obesity, diabetes, and a carbuncle is more extensive and covered by inelastic tissue. And so what you need to think about, and I think for your boards, I really went over this with you because it was on my boards. I just took the boards recently. So I know you're all thinking, oh, my God, your boards were so long ago, it's meaningless. But I just took I took the recert exam for ID, and they actually want to know this. They want to know, so obviously you all know if somebody comes in with a fluctuant carbuncle or furuncle that you're going to IND it, but what they really want to know is that abscess is smaller than 5 centimeters, you're just going to IND it. You're not going to give antibiotics. And so that would be a question on your exam, and actually that's really important for life, for those of us that are seeing a lot of C. diff. Larger abscesses, and obviously if someone's systemically ill, should be managed with IND plus antibiotics. And we're going to go over this. Antibiotic treatment should actually, and there's a lot of misspellings on this, so I have to apologize for this because I did this really quite late at night the other night, and the whole entire lecture didn't save after 3.5 hours. So we had to redo it. So so because there's so much MRSA in the community, and we're going to talk about this, your approach to the outpatient should be Clinda, Bactrim, or Doxy. And for patients that might be sick, you might want to add rifampin because it has excellent activity. Comment about rifampin. Would you ever use rifampin alone in Staph aureus? MRSA, MSSA? No. Why not? I hear no. Why? Static. Do we really care when we IND something that it has to be cidal? I mean, we use static drugs all the time for all sorts of infections. Why do we care if it's static or cidal and in something we've IND'd? Well, then every antibiotic should be cidal, right? So why do we care? You need to be thinking like this. So someone say, yeah, we care. We don't care. Someone thought we cared. No one, everyone else in the room doesn't know. You're not sure. You're not sure. Okay, so you absolutely don't need a cidal drug in this. Cidality is really important for drugs for certain infections. So you would definitely want cidality in an infection like endocarditis. You want cidality. You don't want the drug to be static. So static means you just inhibit it and you don't kill it. You want killing. So an osteomyelitis, you'd like to have a cidal drug, but there's a lot of good data in actually osteomyelitis in children that you can get away with Clinda. So, you really want cidality. For example, endocarditis is really a great example. You'd like to have cidality in meningitis. And I actually like to have cidal drugs when I'm treating osteomyelitis. So cidality would not change me here in this particular infection, because what you're doing with an IND, for the most part, this is a surgical infection, whether you drain it or you go in deeper. This is really a surgical infection. And so all the antibiotic is adjunctive therapy. And so one of your jobs as the primary care clinician, whether you're the ID consult, the medical consult, or you're in the emergency room, is to really know what is, especially with soft tissue, what is a surgical infection, what is surgical primary surgery, and what's you can get away with just medicine. And I really do think that's one of your biggest job with soft tissue infections. And so for those of you in the room that train here, oh, that's all of us. Charlie Norton made a deal with surgery that every single soft tissue infection goes to surgery. So for you, that's great. You get less admissions. Isn't that fabulous? But you are really missing out on an incredibly, amazing experience. Because first of all, I happen to love soft tissue infections. I think they're challenging. And the management is challenging. And you're missing out on that experience. And so when you go out into practice, as whatever you decide to do in medicine, you will be exposed, maybe not cardiology, because you'll just go in and echo people. But everybody else will go in. They'll look at light. No, I'm only kidding. So, you know, we'll all be exposed with soft tissue infections, and so you're going to be missing that experience. So I just want to say, so going back to cytality and everything, again, here primarily we want to IND it, get the pus out, and if it's big enough, you know, you figure basically your IND isn't going to get it. If they're systemically toxic, well, that's different. You're going to admit them and give them IV. But for people you see in your emergency room or your office, you're going to IND it, you're going to have someone else IND it, and you're going to give them adjunctive therapy, and it does not need to be cytal. You're kind of mopping it up is the way to think about it, I think. So I just think, you know, I really tried not to make this. There's only one organism I'm going to spend a lot of time on, but I just wanted to spend a little bit of time, because this isn't an MRSA lecture, and there's a lot of organisms, but I do want to tell you that, you know, we all know there's this community-acquired MRSA, and so, again, going back to surgery, because they see all these infections, they called me up a couple of weeks ago, and they said, oh, we're seeing about 3 to 4 MRSAs in soft tissue in the community. I'm like, no, we're not. And he goes, yes, we are. And then I realized, that's when he told me, they're seeing all the infections and we're not. And then I went and I looked at the data and we really are. And so so from the community, there is this CAMR, or community-acquired MRSA infection. And it first, like, really started to gain a lot of momentum in the literature, I think probably a couple of years ago, because there was a football team that ended up, the players that had a lot of contact with one another came up with the same strain, and it was clear that they were passing it around. The football team was passing it around to one another. Since then, there's been a lot of data on wrestlers, children, and because of the close contact in a moist environment, some people actually think this is a sexually transmitted disease, and so that it's actually carried in the genital region of women. And so clearly there are outbreaks in households, and certainly sexual partners need to be screened when people are carrying CAMRSA. You know, people who have recurrent folliculitis, recurrent infections, and so you do need to be aware of that. It has a specific pattern on PFG, and they frequently carry genes for PVL, which is a cytotoxin, which it's not clear whether or not it confers virulence, but it has been associated with increased morbidity in children and patients with Staph aureus pneumonia. So this has really been, is out for judgment whether or not this is really a virulence factor. When you talk to the surgeons here at Jacoby, what they're saying is they're saying that their MSSA infections and their furuncles, their carbuncles, are easily treated with just an IND. But their MRSA infections look different and they also act different. They are really much more aggressive and sometimes require going to the OR. And so one of the surgeons here, Peter Kim, not Peter Kim from our service, is actually wants to do a little study looking, not a little, get a grant to look at the differences and whether or not one could actually look at predictors of who needs to go to the operating room. So I think that this is a moving target. It's not, I would be shocked if it's on your boards. But you do need to be aware of it just because it is really so new. So this is we're going to be all over the place. A 28-year-old Connecticut man comes in with this ulcer, and it's a rapidly expanding ulcer. So does somebody else want to ask some questions about the patient to me? What does he do for a living? He's a businessman. Excellent. Does he have any spider bites? So you're thinking about a brown recluse spider. So you know, normally, so a brown recluse spider normally has a very necrotic lesion. I tried to find a good picture of it for you. I couldn't really find a good one. And normally, you definitely get a black lesion. But is it normally raised? Is there a lot of edema there? It's normally not raised. It's normally not. They can necrose, and it's an excellent thought. Brown recluse spider is not found normally in Connecticut. It has been reported in Connecticut and New York, normally more in the southern states, but an excellent, excellent thought. Great thought. Great. So it turns out that, and this is a real case, that he actually makes drums out of goat skins that are imported from Africa. So never traveled, but he, so what are you thinking?
Anthrax.
You're thinking anthrax, exactly. So what about it makes you think about anthrax?
Raised edges.
So who's taking care of my patient with leishmania in the hospital? Does it have raised erythematous borders? Yeah, it has raised erythematous. So you want to say something different than what you're saying. There's something different in that picture. You're right, but you're wrong. It's edema. There's a fair amount of edema there. It's not just that it's raised. It's not just rolled borders. There's a lot of edema. Because they're going to show you this on your boards. They're just definitely going to show you. They showed it on my boards, and I got it wrong. I called it leash. So, because I was like, oh, my God. Anyway, so we all know that it's a sporulating gram-positive rod, non-modal, found in soil, animals, so animal hides, anybody that works in, and I'm not going over all of anthrax because this is soft tissue, so I'm doing soft tissue manifestations. And so it's human, it can be human to human in terms of, aerosolized, but that's very uncommon. Clinical findings, incubation is short, so that's, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Papule normally develops, enlarges, and fasciculates, and it becomes surrounded by edema. So edema is going to be the thing because it actually, if you remember, it has lethal factor, edema factor. And so that's actually going to be the thing in the picture or the thing in life that makes you think about it. Plus, it's also very necrotic, and that particular lesion was necrotic. It's painless, and normally there's regional lymphadenopathy. Penicillin used to be the drug of choice, but because of the recent anthrax outbreak back in 6 years ago, I can't remember because I was pregnant, because people think that it might be genetically altered, Cipro or Doxy has become the drug of choice for prophylaxis, so I put it on there. So you don't use penicillin for prophylaxis, you use Cipro or Doxy, which is a real pain for somebody like me. When I was 10 weeks pregnant, I was pretty nauseous, and I didn't want anyone at Jacoby to know that I was pregnant. And I was living in City Island, and I got a phone call that there was somebody with an eschar. It's in the middle of the thing, and can I come and look at it? And I'm thinking, this is the last thing I want to do. I'm 39 years old. I don't have a lot of eggs left, I don't want to go in there and, just having to start taking. So I say to her, I'm pregnant. I don't want anyone to know. She's like, what? I can't hear you. I said, no, I just don't want anyone to know that I'm pregnant. What? You're pregnant. You're here in the OR. Oh, my God, we're so excited. I was like, oh, this is just the worst thing. So anyway, so you'll remember from that story that prophylaxis is something that one does not want to take in pregnancy. So this is another patient with a very painless lesion and regional lymphadenopathy. So what is that? You want to ask me questions? I'll tell you the story. This is a 13-year-old admitted to pediatrics at Jacoby. What's the worst that happens? Your friends make fun of you on email. I mean, what can be wrong? So what?
Is there any lymphadenopathy?
Is there any what?
Axillary.
Yes, there's an axillary lymphadenopathy. No, just looks just like that. I had better pictures. I just didn't put them in there. You could actually see the adenopathy going up the arm. What? I can't hear. Cats, no cats. Excellent question, no cats.
Rodents.
What?
Rodents.
So you're thinking about what with rodents? Because if you ask the question, I'm going to ask you what they carry. Is this a problem about being up here? I really can't hear. I mean, first of all, I'm an aged woman. But the second thing is you're all down there. Plague. Yeah, he's really non-toxic, but yeah, and normally it doesn't ulcerate like that. Normally it's a bubo. So, but you were getting at something else that actually has an eschar with rodents. So what am I thinking about that has an eschar with rodents that I don't have a picture? I have a picture, but I don't have it with me. Yeah, rickettsial pox, right. No, not Q fever. Q fever does not have a lesion. So Q fever, Coxiella burnetii, how is Coxiella burnetii gotten? It's aerosolized, yeah. It's aerosolized. But it's not coughed. It's from parchment to animal material. So I know, you were thinking, it's hard when someone's, pimping you in front of everyone. So, yeah, it's aerosolized, that's right. So it's different than every other rickettsial, okay, that there is, all right? Rickettsial pox is what? Carried by what?
Mice.
The bite of the mite, right? So the mouse, so the mite of the mouse, okay? And so at the bite of the mouse, you get a vasculitis thrombosis, and you get first a papule that ulcerates. And that's the eschar. And then the patient, a few days later, gets, you know, headache, fever, completely sort of indistinguishable from any other rickettsial disease, except for, I think, Q fever. In my mind, I learn all the rickettsial diseases together, and I always put Q fever on its own, because Q fever is always in my differential diagnosis of endocarditis, FUO, blah, blah, blah. And that's the way I sort of think about it, you know? Okay. So, oh, we didn't get to the diagnosis, though. Not even close. Oh, good, good, excellent. Love that. I was going to actually pimp you. I was looking to really torture you. So what are you thinking about? Spore trichosis. Excellent thought. So definitely, did he have exposure to plants? He worked in the farm area of Ecuador, in the mountains of Ecuador, and had just come here. It was a 14-year-old boy that got in a car with about 10 other people and drove here from Ecuador after taking a boat and a car all the way here. So Derm thought it was spore trichosis, so that's definitely a thought. Normally, you don't get an eschar like this, but yeah. What? Coining? Coining. So normally coining is something that people do from the Asia, and normally what they do, and it's in X, I should have put a picture of coining up here, but you know what? I didn't want to do like a whole travel thing, so I have a ton of travel pictures with infections. I just feel like, so coining, for those of you that don't know, in Asia, when the people have fevers, they take coins and they move them along in this sort of sometimes Christmas tree pattern, I would say, right? But it's a linear pattern, and it is really bizarre when you see it, because someone comes in with a fever and they've got this really linear pattern, and you have to ask, did you have coining performed? Normally with coining, there is normally not an ulcer associated with coining. So a good thought, but not coining. Something else? So the patient had leishmania, and it's very funny. So this not this exact picture, but this picture was shown on my boards, and I said there is just no way leishmania has a like an eschar like that. And so there's a whole list of eschar lesions that one can have. And so we talked about anthrax. I now put leishmania on it. You said rickettsial. There are other rickettsial diseases, right? Rickettsial. Acari can also have an eschar in it. Rickettsia tichigamushi can have one. It's been renamed. And so a lot of the rickettsial diseases. But I never had leish as an eschar. And so I actually had an eschar without edema on my boards. Without edema, so I said, oh my God, there's no edema, and anthrax always has edema, but I'm putting that this is anthrax, and it was leish, all right? And then the next day, this patient got admitted. So I was like, got that? It's so funny, the fellow looked at me, she goes, you got that wrong, Dr. Coyle, because she had put it was leish. So there's no edema around this, and you can't see it from here, but it's what you were talking about, there are rolled up borders. Spore trichosis was another possibility. So spore trichosis is a fungus which one gets inoculated from, like, especially rose bushes, and so you need to know about that for your boards. And so this is leishmania. So what is this? This is a patient that comes in with a facial rash. This is a classic picture. No, so we're going to go over a group A strep. It is associated with group A strep. No one knows? No, it's erysipelas. So erysipelas is a facial rash. It's normally in the superficial skin, but it involves the lymphatics. And so you get a raised lesion. And so if you were to touch it at the edge of these lesions, it would just be raised, as opposed to a cellulitis, which you never can feel the demarcation of the lesion. So it's literally raised. And so I put another picture of it, I think, up for you. And this is, I think, shows you a better feeling of it being raised. So it's a raised, normally it's bilaterally, but it can be unilaterally. It's almost uniformly associated with group A strep. And if you were to biopsy the edge of the lesion and Gram stain it, you would see group A strep there. The patients look non-toxic, and it's not really clear what the portal of entry is. Some people think it's a sore throat. And why some people react with, you know, a sore throat or purulent manifestations of group-based strep, and why some people get erysipelas is really not clear. So this is erysipelas. You need to know it, and you need to know it's caused by group-based strep. There is no resistance to penicillin to group-based strep as opposed to Staph aureus. So we just talked about this, superficial cellulitis, lymphatic involvement. And so, it was interesting doing this for you because I have my own perceptions because, when I was a chief resident, we gave morning report every day. So I have to tell you that's most of my fund of knowledge comes from that. And so going back and seeing how much epi has changed, because it's good I did this talk, because when I was a resident, all the erysipelas we saw was on the face, but apparently now it is much more common on the lower extremities. And it's more common in children, older adults, and also infants. And normally the skin is intact as opposed to other soft tissue. We talked about the raised border, and it's very sharply demarcated from the other normal skin. And so what did I do here? Cellulitis. So this extends deeper than erysipelas, and so we're going to talk a little bit about cellulitis. So I just wanted to make a couple of points about this. There's not a lot to say about cellulitis, in my opinion, in that, but I did wanted to just tell you a bunch of things. So this is a 42-year-old male with a history. He's a diabetic with left foot and groin pain. So he comes in and he's got no portal of entry. What do you think this is? And I just saw a patient recently that like this that no one examined. So I want to make a comment about that. What do you think it is? Fungal? Do you think this is fungal? You think that the portal of entry is inter? Yeah, it was. It actually was. So the portal of entry was probably a fungal infection between the toes. So it's really a very, very small portal of entry. So normally it's beyond actually what your eye can appreciate. So fine. So if you think that was the portal of entry, what do you think the organism was? No. So any comments? Somebody just, you guys have to practice. I've already been around a while. In fact, I'm actually thinking about retiring. So, you know, you have your whole life ahead of you. So, and I'm not going to be there hanging with you. So what do you think when you get to the bedside? What else would you like to do? Would you like to see some other part of the patient? Yeah, let's think about that groin pain. What do you think the groin pain could be? Like, if that guy came to me, I'd be like, oh, know what it is. So what do you think it is? Because that's the way you got to be. You got to be like, when the patient's telling you something, you got to be like, oh, yeah, this is my differential. Da, 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 da. So what do you think? You're like, it's a little hard at your stage. But when someone's telling you something, you definitely want to look. But the minute he tells you that with that leg, it should get you, you should be like, I think I know what's going on. What could be hurting in the groin? A lymph node, right. And so if a lymph node's hurting, this would be a case of group A strep lymphangitis. So so for those of you that, I mean, I think I can say this pretty, so for those of you, somebody admitted Dr. Zalewski recently, so that's why I didn't want this on the thing. So, and I went to see him and no one had looked. And he had a streak going up his leg and also had a lymph node in his groin. Not one person. The attending came in and said, oh, forgot to look. So, no, you don't want to be that person. You don't want to be the person that forgot to look. All right? So let's go look. And it's really hard to see. You'll just have to appreciate. We're going to see it on another patient. There is a pink streak going right up the leg, right into the groin where there's a lymph node. This is a lymphangitis. Lymphangitis is almost always caused by group A strep. And it's a syndrome, a soft tissue. So you need to know that syndrome. You need to always look in someone's groin and look up and examine their lymph nodes. Staph tends to not do that, all right? Staph is reported to do it. And if somebody is critically ill, I cover staph. But for the most part, this is a disease caused by group A strep. Okay, so it's, first of all, it's not, Like anything else, it's about antibiotics, right? So if it's staph, what are you going to do in an inpatient hospitalized? You're going to give vanco, right? So you don't have to give vanco in that setting, right? Because you're pretty sure. So we're going to talk a little bit about Clinda later on. So it was really hard because group A strep, is you're going to see, is interdigitated through this talk. So to me, one of the sexiest organisms in the world is group A strep. And I think you're seeing it here. We've already seen a follicula, we've seen impetigo, we've seen erysipelas, and now we've seen lymphangitis. All the different manifestations that group A strep can do. And we're going to talk a little bit how you would approach it, group A strep. But your antibiotic management would be different. Plus, also, patients with group A strep lymphangitis are very sick. And I get very concerned because you can actually get toxic shock syndrome, and also you can get a neck fasciitis. Normally not in the setting of lymphangitis, but I am on top of a lymphangitis like crazy. You know, I normally have surgery at the beginning, and I'm normally quite, they get sick. They're febrile, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. So patient admitted to ortho. Has the sudden onset of finger pain, and this is what he's got. So what do you think? What? No cats, nothing. Nothing. Does nothing, nothing. What? Start what? No. No paronychia, nothing. Nothing that we could see. So, what's your differential? Is it a cellulitis? Well, it's definitely a cellulitis. It's hot and it's warm, right? So what this is going on there, it's white. So white tissue tells you that there is probably the beginning of death. So there's necrosis there. So this is a serious infection. You know, it's really hard to examine these patients to know whether or not they can bend and whether or not their joint is involved because they cannot bend their fingers. Hand infections, this is another thing you never see, nor should it be admitted to medicine. The reason why hand infections should not be admitted to medicine, you should have medical emergencies and medical urgencies in your mind. Hand infection is a medical urgency because when they move along tendons, they can cause destruction and loss of function. And loss of function of one's hand changes the whole trajectory of one's life. And so a hand infection to me is an emergent or urgent situation. And so you'll see when you take care of, you don't know how many people I see with infected cat bites. And they've seen another physician that didn't give them antibiotics. You need to take cat bites, anything, any inoculum into the hand seriously, all right? Because there's not a lot of space in the fascia. There's a lot of nerves and a lot of tendons. They get trapped and they can get destroyed, all right? And so surgery needs to be involved the minute you see a hand infection. Not tomorrow, not tonight, okay? The minute you should be seeing them. So normally an ID, we're seeing them when they're on surgery already. This patient was on orthopedic surgery. I actually handed this patient over to Carol Harris. And the patient had this sausage-like digit. And we were concerned about either staph or group A strep. But it also could have been group B strep. So any gram-positive organism is what we were concerned about. And she and I were greatly concerned about the loss of the function of that finger. And we wanted an MRI, and we wanted them to go in, and nothing happened. So they put antibiotics on the patient. And after about 3 days of the patient not getting better, they went in and they – I just have to look. I have 15 minutes, and I have like 80 slides. They went in and they debrided it, and it grew group A strep. So this is a group A strep necrotizing cellulitis, all right? So these infections need to be explored. And your biggest problem is fighting with surgery here at least. This is another case of a patient that presented to me after doing heavy weightlifting and came in with a red thumb. And I actually had orthopedics see it and look at the joint. And they said the joint's fine and that I was crazy. It just give him some Motrin. That was on a Wednesday, and on Friday he told me he had a red streak going up his arm. And so again, no portal of entry. probably, again, you know, he was lifting. He probably had a small little neck. And so this was a group A strep lymphangitis. He had a painful lymph node in his axilla, which definitely wasn't there the day. He actually came to me to rule out chikungunya fever. And I was like, okay, not chikungunya fever, but I think you've got a cellulitis of the soft tissue. And so I listened to orthopedics, didn't give him antibiotics, and he came in with a group A strep lymphangitis. So no portal of entry in these rapidly expanding infections really makes you think about a group A strep. Classically, staph normally has a portal of entry, but again, you know, both of them can occur in the setting of fungal infection. So this is just Phyllis went crazy, showing, oh, wait, this is his finger that initially, see, he came in with this little erythema here. Pretty, it was really unimpressive and a little bit of warmth. Okay, so this is a patient who came in with erythema and drainage after stepping on a plastic toy. And you can see she looks much different than our group A strep infections. She's developing these kind of, again, golden type lesions there. And so this is a Staph aureus infection from a direct inoculation in this particular patient. And she was obese, so that was also, I think, her risk factor. So I just want to give you the flavor of the difference between group A strep and staph. I mean, a lot of times we cover both of them, but I just, you should kind of think, and this is her again, and you can see the erythema, and you can see she had chronic stasis. And there she is again, and it was dripping, and it grew staph. I want to make a comment about this. This is a 54-year-old diabetic male with facial pain, nasal stuffiness, swelling, and erythema. Let's say he comes to your clinic. This is what he looks like. You see those little crusts there on his nose. He says he was picking at it. So we never knew what that was, but we never grew it. Sometimes you don't grow it, right? So let's say he goes to your clinic. What would you be thinking about? Obviously, it's a cellulitis of his face. But so what do you think? You would, and his eyes are closed. It's not that he's obtunded. He's disclosing his eyes. So what would you think? Well, this is, so he's a diabetic. He looks really fine. His eyes are completely not involved. But I guess it could be mucor. But it's pretty rapid. I mean, I guess so. We'll talk about that. It would be an unusual. Sinuses weren't involved. It would be unusual for mucor. I mean, he's got those little, I mean, it looks like staph, actually, right? So this looks like a staph aureus facial cellulitis. So let him go home or admit him? Or what are the complications? Is this like, remember we just talked about the hand and how big, what a big deal the hand is? Is this a big deal? Yeah, it's a big deal. So why is it a big deal? Right, so you're saying all sorts of things, but so all of the face, the lymphatics from the face drain back, and the veins of the face, and the veins all go back to this cavernous sinus, and so this could really be end up being an intracranial infection. So you know, if you have this just fabulously compliant patient that looks great, and you want to give him antibiotics, and then see him the next day, probably not unreasonable. But in the emergency room here at Jacoby, where you're not so sure of your follow-up, you would want to really watch this patient closely. However you do it, you don't want to see this patient in 4 weeks. You want to see the patient the next day to make sure that they're getting better. Because facial cellulitis, just like the hand infection, I just put it there because it is something that you don't take lightly, all right? And there, the portal of entry is definitely the nose. When it's the sinuses, that even gets even more crazy, and we'll talk about that. And this is just another patient. This is a 20-year-old man who presented status post a fall from a height. And you can see here, in this particular patient had a mixed infection. He actually had a penetrating wound. And so in that situation, you cover gram-negatives, gram-positives, and staph aureus also. And you can see, though, that's really quite a – that is an infection you want to have your surgeons involved with. This is a 32-year-old alcoholic who just returned from Chesapeake Bay, where he ate oysters for dinner, and now presents toxic with this these bile and this soft tissue infection. So, what do we think? Vitriol. Right, Vibrio vulnificus. So you really need to know this because I don't know that they're. You said it was on your boards, right? Yeah, it's so weird that it was on your boards. So it was on my medicine boards, and it was like, what is this? Was it, what is this? What, did they ask what it was? So, okay, so my medicine boards, they're like, what is this? And you had to say it was Vibrio vulnificus. On my ID boards, he was in septic shock, and he was tubed, and they said, what do you treat him with? And you know, so Doxy was on there, and I was like, oh, no, he needs imipenem. He's really sick. And I gave him imipenem, so the answer was Doxy. So so in the ID boards, I think they want you to know what to do, and the medicine boards, they want you to know this syndrome. They do really want you to know this. And this is just from down on the web. You can see it's a necrotic ulcer. And so this is a Vibrio, and it likes salt water or brackish water. And so this is a little bit different than other Vibrios, which can cause soft tissue infections. Although this can occur by actually having the organism go in a braided skin, normally it's after somebody who is immunocompromised with liver disease, classically an alcoholic, and after they ingest the raw oysters, which are contaminated, they get a disseminated septicemia that goes to the soft tissue, and they develop this sort of myonecrosis that you see. And so the treatment is tetracyclines or third-generation cephalosporins. And I don't think they're going to ask you the treatment, but they do want you to know they do want you to know this diagnosis. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on necrotizing infections of the skin and the fascia. This is something that I'm really interested in, and I really love to take care of, even though they're hard infections. And so with necrotizing fasciitis, it has no respect for fascial planes, and the infection is rapidly moving, and this that we talked about urgent, this is a medical emergency. And so one of the biggest problems you have as the medical person is trying to figure out what is a neck fasciitis. And so the pathology is extensive tissue destruction, thrombosis, and so therefore death of the tissue, and the bacteria spreads along the fascial planes. And so you need to really break it up in your mind. And so this is just a normal picture of the skin, and it just shows you the epidermis, the dermis, subcutaneous tissue, and fascia with all the vessels going through it. And then they show you this little picture of what happens when you start getting an infection. So stage one, you know, you start getting, if it's type one infection, which you're going to talk about, you get gas, you get necrosis of, you get thrombosis of the arteries, you get liquefaction, necrosis, and then you get death. And so the skin looks purple. Purple skin is never good. Nobody that we know has been born with purple skin. So purple skin means death. So not a good thing. And then you ultimately get ulceration of the epidermis, which we're going to look at. And so this is from the web, but we're going to see a lot of patients from Jacobi on here. And I just want to show you anything that's black like that or purple like that is telling you in the fascial level and the fascial planes there's death of tissue. So there's thrombosis, probably associated with infection and death. And so this is an emergency and needs to be removed. So you need to break it up in your mind between type 1 and type 2. And type 1 is, and you're probably a medicine mostly going to see type 2, but I just have to watch. Type 1 is caused by mixed infection by aerobic and anaerobic bacteria. Most commonly, it occurs after surgical procedures, but it can occur in the setting of peripheral vascular disease and diabetes, which is what you're most familiar with. And a type 2 is normally monomicrobial, most commonly caused by group A strep, but there have been cases with this community-acquired MRSA, which seems to be much more aggressive, as we originally started the lecture, than the previous MRSA and MSSA. And so clinical manifestations are rapid progression from inapparent process to associated with destruction of tissue. Normally, the patient is systemically toxic, loss of limb or death. Normally, this is the thing I want to say to you, unexplained pain or pain out of proportion to your exam should make you terrified. And I cannot tell you how many times I used to come in, especially when I was a chief or when I was associate medical director and I used to see all the cases in the house, in the medical ICU, and somebody came in with like a swollen leg, but pain out of proportion to the exam, and the surgical intern said, oh, I think it's a DVT. And, you know, you're like, okay, this needs to come off like in the next 20 seconds. And so, again, when you think you have a critically ill patient with a soft tissue infection, and we just did an M&M. You were at that M&M, and the great that were you on the team that took care of the patient? The team that took care of the patient didn't do well, but the team taking care of the patient got surgery attendings involved, and the patient went to the OR within 20 minutes of seeing the exam, as opposed to we called, they didn't come, they sent an intern that was, you know, chewing their McDonald's hamburger and then went to get a chief and blah, blah, blah. So you really need to get and when you see blisters or bullae, you should be scared. And systemic toxicity, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You should be scared. We just went over this in conference, and how do you tell the difference between a neck fasciitis? For me, I actually don't use this, but I thought it was interesting because we just used it on one of our patients. But you can see the things that one would see in somebody who's got a necrotizing fasciitis: a high C-reactive protein, a high white count, a low sodium, a high creatinine, a high glucose. So they all get points. But the bottom line is, normally the patient has looks toxic. Their CPKs may or may not be elevated. So don't let a low CPK fool you, but you should get it. And the lack or presence of, obviously presence of compartment syndrome is scary, but lack of compartment syndrome should not dissuade you from this diagnosis. How do you work it up? You know, we do tissue x-rays because we want to see if there's gas there, because it moves us in one direction or the other. And we always do blood cultures because they are actually positive in 60% of the cases with gas. Group A strep, they're also very commonly positive, as opposed to the lymphangitis and everything else we saw. Those are normally negative. And if it's staph aureus, it should be positive too. So with type 1, which is associated postoperatively or with diabetes, we normally see multiple organisms. So staph aureus and strep, enterococci, E. coli, peptostreptococcus, but then you also start seeing BFRAG and Clostridium. And so the reason why, especially in diabetics, as time goes on and their ulcers get actually colonized with bowel organisms. So you start seeing actually gram positives, but now you also start seeing bowel organisms in these patients, and they act synergistically to form this necrotizing infection. And so if you see a diabetic like this, again, there's a necrotic lesion on the bottom of the foot. And we just saw a patient like this about 6 months ago. And the surgeon saw the patient, and the patient actually had air in the soft tissue, but they said, oh, it's probably from the ulcer. And the patient sat, and they debrided it. They did a local debridement, and then they, you know, and the patient had a bicarb of 12, had a very, very high white count, and, you know, I was the ID attending, and I'm like, there's just only one thing you're going to do for this patient, right? This is a situation where you can give antibiotics till the cows come home. Antibiotics are useless when there's necrotic tissue, because how are the antibiotics going to get there? There is no blood supply there. And so you've got nice necrotic tissue. If it's a diabetic, you've got glucose, and you've got no antibiotics getting there. So you've got to remove the dead tissue. You've got to debride that. And in this type of a setting, you really actually have to take the foot off. You really can't, in my opinion, do a local debridement. I mean, you're going to see this as a local debridement here. But ultimately, these patients go, and they end up having their foot off. This is not a Jacoby patient, by the way. I just wanted to just say a couple of things. This is a really long slide. It's just to remind me to tell you that there's a couple of things. When you have a superficial diabetic foot infection, and we're talking, you know, not open, etc., early on, it's normally aerobic gram-positive. Staph aureus, group B strep, Strep A. galactia, and normally Staph aureus, either methicillin-resistant, sometimes Staph epi. And so in that situation, you normally give just, if the person isn't systemically ill, you give them coverage for gram-positive. And so if you want to sort of extend it out because they're systemically ill, what is a good drug that you could use in somebody with the first-time infection and you wanted to maybe get more of a polymicrobial coverage? What are some? There's actually a nice drug. Unicin, right, Unicin. So it's a real problem because in surgery, they always want Zosyn for these infections. And you sort of don't want to give them Zosyn for a number of reasons because many of them are going to be coming back and forth and you really just don't want to change their flora so quickly. And so you want to really give appropriate therapy. You know, look, I'm not going to withhold Zosyn in somebody who's critically ill. But we're talking about the majority of patients that come in with their first or second infection. I just wanted to make a comment about ulcers that are deep or chronically infected. We talked about that before, that those are normally the polymicrobial infections. And so in that situation, you normally have Enterococci and Enterobacteriaceae there. And Pseudomonas is there, but it's only in about 5% of the cases. And so, again, we give Pseudomonas because most of these people, we give Zosyn because many of these people have been in and out of the hospital, and even their Enterobacteriaceae have become resistant. When we have necrosis or gangrene, like what we just saw, you really have to give anaerobic strep and Bacteroides coverage and Clostridium. So if we saw someone toxic from a diabetic foot fasciitis, like we just saw, you know, in that setting, imipenem is not a bad choice. It has excellent Clostridia coverage, excellent anaerobic coverage, excellent gram-positive, and you would add vanco for MRSA. And so imipenem and vanco would be a definitely reasonable choice in somebody with a neck fasciitis of the foot secondary to a diabetic foot ulcer. I just wanted to make a comment because it always comes up, and I'm not really asked to go over this, but I just osteomyelitis. This is, I think, one of the most, and this probably in itself should be its own talk. You really should have a diabetic foot talk because it's really, I think, for most of you that go into primary care is what you're going to deal with a fair amount of time. But, you know, with osteomyelitis, if you see visible bone or you can probe it, you know clinically that this person has osteo. You don't need to get your MRI on that patient. That your diagnosis is made. Maybe if you want to know the extent of the osteo, you will do it. But to diagnose osteo, you don't need to do it. For ulcers greater than 2 by 2 centimeters or greater than 3 millimeters of depth, I ask for an MRI. If the ulcer lasts greater than 1 to 2 weeks, and obviously if the SED rate is elevated. And this is a real problem. If you look in the literature on the diabetic foot ulcer, they tell you to get a bone biopsy. So I'm thinking, and I've been here since 1988, it is now 2008, and I think I've seen one bone biopsy done. So I think at Jacoby, the likelihood that you're going to get a bone biopsy is probably pretty close to nil, right? So it's unfortunate, but when you go out to practice, there's a lot of good literature on radiologists that do this for a living and really help you do bone biopsies non-invasively. So it's something just for you to know, to really try to get a bone biopsy if you can. And why? Because, you know, if you give the person, you know, whatever it is, you know, whatever you decide on, I mean, it's really hard to give someone Zosyn for 6 weeks for an osteo, and you know, it's a very hard drug to give. It's given quite frequently, so you really want to be able to target. And most people on 6 weeks of many of these antibiotics will drop their platelets, and they're very hard to manage, and they get a lot of side effects. So you do, if you know what you're dealing with, it makes the ultimate long-term care of the patient so much better. You know, your mother can open up Sanford Guide and look at the presumptive treatment. But really having an organism is what you really need. And sending it for anaerobic cultures, too, is quite important. So I just want to spend a few minutes on Fournier's gangrene, which is another type of type 1 neck fasciitis. This normally occurs in the perineal region. And normally it's a penetration of the GI or urethral mucosa by the enteric organisms. We see it a lot in obese diabetic patients, and in males it commonly spreads either to the abdomen or in men, scrotum and penis. And it's normally a mixture of gram-positives and gram-negative and anaerobics. And When I was a medical student, it was the first case that I scrubbed in on was a Fournier gangrene, and they had to close the whole entire OR suite because the odor was so foul that the rest of the ORs could not go. So everybody else, and this is a true story. It was at the VA in Brooklyn, and it was just so foul smelling because it's really very much a mixed infection with anaerobes. And by the way, you should always ask your surgeons when they're in the OR, how did it smell? Surgeons will tell you how it smelled, how it looked. It's missing from everybody's notes, those details. So this is not a patient from the web. This is a patient from the emergency room that I saw. And so this is a patient with Fournier's gangrene. And you can see here that the skin is purple. So we know already that there's necrotizing. You know, the vessels are thrombosing. There's death of the skin. And we know that there's bulla there. And, you know, these patients have to be put in the lithotomy position. And they have to be widely debrided. Everything has to come off. And then they take them back day after day after day. And so you want to, you know, you really want to get your microbiology, because if you start this patient on imipenem, he's not going home next week, right? So he's going home in like 10 weeks, maybe 20 weeks. So if you start an imipenem, where are you going after that? You know, so you want to be really careful about your antibiotics in these patients. So when you start your antibiotics, you want to get your cultures from the OR and pair back and really target, because the treatment of choice for this particular disease is surgery. Surgery, surgery, surgery. You can give antibiotics all day long and all night, the patient will still die. It's surgery. Oh, this is hours. Hours. So the patient will tell you they have pain. You'll go down, you won't see that much. And then you'll come back like 7 hours later and you'll see it moves right, like 24, 48 hours. It will extend over that rapidly. And you really, people do not look in people's crevices. I mean, look, if I got admitted to the unit, my crevices are easy. But if I weighed 500 pounds, we've all admitted patients like that. You know, right? You have to, like, move things, right? And how many of us have thrown a stethoscope on a tubed patient? Come on, been there. Ask the nurse, and we throw it on. It's the middle of the night. We press on the belly, and we don't pull the diaper down. You know, you got to pull that diaper down. So I was rounding with Diane Maggiore, like, about 3 years ago, and they had a septic patient. They didn't have – I'm like, we got to look in the diaper. This is an obese diabetic, and sure enough, right in the crevice, we had to pull the crevice apart, and right in there was a neck fasciitis. Yeah. So, you know, and if you don't, sometimes it's a necrotizing cellulitis and it's group A strep, but, you know, normally it's a mixed infection. So you got to look, especially your obese diabetic patients, you have to know about this infection, all right? Normally they start with pain first. So many of our patients come in and they can't give us a history, you know what I mean? They're tubed already, you know, you don't know what happened. This is one of those things that I've never seen. And you've already heard Lou Weiss talk, and I remember when I was an ID fellow for my first case of whatever it was, and he started giving me every type of cellulitis in the book, and he said, well, you know what a Melanie's cellulitis is? And I was like, yes, I do. And I was thinking, I have no clue what that is. I didn't want him to know, you know. So I had to run and look it up, and then, you know, later on in life, I told him that I didn't know. So it's rare. It occurs postoperatively. I'm not going to go into this with you. I have a very, very basic science lecture on synergy. It's actually a wonderful lecture that Dr. Porofsky asked me to give, and I actually use this because one of the things about many of these infections, like we just saw the Fourniers, this is our own flora that we live very happily with, and our flora in our intestines helps keep us healthy, and there's this wonderful balance that goes on. And if you think about it, all of us were to donate stool today, right? And we were going to go and culture it and look for bacteroides, you know, like less than 2% of our stool would be BFRAG. But yet, if we all had gunshot wounds right now, and we all had post-operative abscesses, all of us would have BFRAG in our abscess. And so that delicate balance of changing the redox potential and lowering the oxidation and then having an aerobe that also utilizes oxygen, again lowering the oxidative potential, increases the ability for anaerobes to now, you know, does anybody watch like on videos, Good Girls Gone Bad, right? They go down to Florida and they start going in those contests, but meanwhile they're like in Harvard, you know? So this is like good anaerobes gone bad. Think about it that way. So it's like your anaerobes is just like, whoa, low redox potential. And so what happens is they just like really cause a lot of necrotizing infections when they do that. And I think it's just something that actually, as a physician, it's that fine balance in terms of our milieu that is kind of interesting. And so this is what it looks like. You can see here, it's necrotizing here. So whenever you see black, you know, and skin. We've said this over and over again. This is something that we, and I'm telling you, surgeons a lot of times don't get that excited. I mean, the attendings do, but the residents tend not to. So type 2 necrotizing fasciitis is caused by GAS, group A strep, and again, CAMRSA has been more commonly described, and toxic shock syndrome is common in this setting. And predisposing factors are blunt trauma, varicella, IV drug user, childbirth, or sometimes we just don't see an inciting predisposing factor. But if those of you, I'm trying to think how old most of you were in 1990. So you probably were too young, but there was, before the varicella vaccine was widely used, and group A strep was on the rise. And I always say this to you because we're going to spend a little time on group A strep. So I always have to ask this question for those of you that have been in Morning Report, and I've asked it, no, that's not me, and I've asked it, who's read Little Women here? I think you also raised your hand last time. You are the only person in the residency that's run. I think that needs to be on some sort of website. One person in the residency has read. My God, should I throw out some more classics and see if people have read them? All right, so what did Beth die of? Do you remember what Beth died of? What? Someone said it. Did someone say it? Not rheumatic fever, scarlet fever. Scarlet fever. So someone said scarlet fever at the beginning of the lecture about something else. So do you die of scarlet fever today? No, you don't. No, so that's good. You'll always remember that. So the epidemiology of group A strep is ever moving. And people would get, and we're going to talk about scarlet fever, because scarlet fever is caused by group A strep, but what part of group A strep is it caused by? Somebody laugh. You're going to get called in because you're laughing. So what is it caused by? What is it caused by? No, we're talking about, what are we talking? Okay, all right. Someone behind you hiding? What is it caused by? What part of the group? What's the pathogenesis? What? You keep on answering them again. What? Who said it? Yeah, toxin, right. Toxin production, right. So, toxin production. And so what you get, though, it's a little different than fasciitis. And so in that situation, patients probably have antibody to M protein, and so they're able to control it better. And so it's toxin production. And so the toxin, they get a toxin. So in nowadays, they just get an erythroderm. And that's real. I mean, you know, they're a little sick, but they get an erythroderm. But it used to be that you used to die from it. And so so when I was a resident, you know, it's hard to listen to that. I know you're all thinking, I'm going to just kill her and shoot her one day when she says that because she says it so much. But when I was a resident, we never saw group A strep. But when I was an ID fellow, that's all we saw. So the epidemiology in the 1990s, we saw a lot of group A strep. You know, and then 2000, CAMRSA has come on the scene. So these are all changing epis, and you have to realize that. And so scarlet fever is actually caused by the toxin. And so in this particular setting, we saw a lot of neck fasciitis in the 1990s before the vaccine, secondary to chickenpox. And so that was your portal of entry, and it was called in the newspaper the flesh-eating bacteria, right? Do you remember that? The flesh-eating bacteria. So that was really group-A strep, and that was the setting we really, and right about then, it just took off and we saw a lot of group-A strep. So I don't know. I just want to see what my next slide, because I don't know what I'm going to say next in it. Oh, okay. So let's look at this lady, and then let's talk about pathogenesis. So this is a lady that I got called down to the emergency room to see, and she sees she's tubed, so she's hypotensive, and she was found on the floor. Her daughter had talked to her 48 hours prior. She was fine. And then they called her the next day. She wasn't answering, and then they got really scared, and they went over to get her, and she wasn't answering, you know, blah, blah, blah. You all know the routine. Then they got someone to break the door down, and she was lying there. So you can see that she's got purple skin. She's got bulla that are rupturing, right? So I think even just by looking at her, you're thinking by the way, that arm was cold, cold, cold. It almost seemed like she had just a large vessel obstructed at first. But, you know, she was toxic. Her white count was up. She was hypotensive, acidemic. And so the differential diagnosis of this particular patient is what? So we think it's a neck fasciitis, I hope. So what are the possibilities? What? So remember, I said this to somebody the other day. You know, act confident when you say something, because it's really a good thing to learn. So whispering is not helping me. I can't hear anyway. So just say it. What's the big deal? Oh, my God, I scared. What? Just treat him? Oh, Clostridium, I'm sorry. I really can't hear. This is just awful up here. I can't, there's just something in the background. Okay, just Clostridium. Clostridium what? Okay, so she threw herself out, so someone help her. So how do you get Clostridium perfringens? What'd you say? I can't hear, what? I'm so sorry, you're really going to have to... I have some sort of generator behind me. Open wound. Traumatic wound. Not open wound, traumatic wound, right? Because we all have open wounds, you know, and we talked about everything, but it's a traumatic wound, right? So we saw a lot of Clostridia perfringens during wars, right? Because what happens with a traumatic wound... Well, okay, shock and all that, but, oh, sharp, yeah, sharp. But they're also inoculating something. What are they inoculating? Spores from the soil. I hope that's what you said. If it's not what you said, just shake your head. Yeah, that's what I said. Soil. Yeah. So, like an open wound. I mean, I guess I could go in the soil, but for the most part, my open wound is going to be the group A strep, the staph, blah blah blah, everything we talked about. But if you're immunocompetent, but in a traumatic wound, so when I'm out in Iraq and I get a missile penetrating through me, through my pants, through the soil, you know, I'm at risk. So what do they do? They basically, you have to take it off. So you have to debride it. You have to debride out. So really, between World War I and World War II, the incidence of Clostridium myonecrosis went down not to zero, but very, very low, because that's why they started getting, you know, they started getting Meditents out on the field. So the minute the guys would come in, they would get debrided. Because if you don't debride them, you know, I have this great thing that I show to the medical students where, if those of you that remember, Gone with the Wind, and Scarlett has to help. Does anybody remember that? And she has to help, and she's like, oh, you know, Dr. So-and-so, I gotta go. And there's a guy, and she's going, oh, because she smells, right? And it's Clostridium myonecrosis that they're getting at. And the doctor goes, he doesn't touch the guy, and he says, the leg has to go off, remember? And she goes, you see the leg up, and you hear the guy, because you hear him going, and then Scarlett faints. So anyway, so you'll remember that. You'll remember traumatic wounds, okay? So, you know, in the Civil War, you know, they're laying around in the dirt. You know, there's no one out there helping them, and they're being inoculated with spores from the environment. So we're getting the sense that this lady wasn't out in the gang wars, right? She was about 72, so she's probably not traumatic, right? There is another Clostridia that we'll talk about, but no one said it. Tortellina? Tetani. Tetanus doesn't present normally like this. Sordelli, I think you're thinking of. Septicum, right. So you want to tell us about septicum? From my lecture? So that is like amazing that you remember that. I don't mean that obnoxiously, because that means if you, when I gave morning report for the first time, I had someone watch me. He had been the chief of medicine at Einstein back in the 80s. He was an amazing man, and at the time he was dying of a T-cell Sézary syndrome. And he came and he watched me, and I gave so much information. He's like, oh, that's just wonderful. Wow, you really gave them like all of Harrison's. Isn't that fabulous? They got nothing from it. So if you can get one thing from my lecture, which you did, that means I am a success. So right now I could leave. So I'm very happy you remember Clostridium with really dark skin. So does somebody else know anything about Clostridium septicum? Okay, so Clostridium septicum is found in the bowel, and normally it's associated with GI malignancies, and it's, remember we talked about our Vibrio vulnificus, so in that setting, the person had a bacteremia that then seeded the skin as opposed to a direct inoculation. Septicum is the same way. Patients get septicemic, and then they seed their skin, and they come in with really basically pain out of proportion to their exam, and purplish skin, meaning necrosis that is expanding, and then they die of shock. Septicum is definitely a good, I'm going to leave it on the list. What else? So just septicum, that's all it can be. Everybody is with septicum. Well, we could give penicillin and we'd probably do okay, it turns out. So the differential is not just septicum. The differential is group A strep, necrotizing fasciitis, and possibly a type 1, but I can't really figure out how she could get a type 1. But we had no history. But septicum is definitely a good choice. So what you want to do, she was way too sick, but you want to do a plain film. Because if there's gas in the tissue, it could be a type 1, meaning the mixed infection with a gas-producing organism, or it could be septicum. But group A strep will not give you gas in the skin. So we didn't do that because she was really, really quite sick. So I went down with Dr. Narula. We put a needle in. We gram-stated it, and we saw gram-positive cocci in chains, which grew group A strep. So I think that what you need to think about with group A strep, we've seen so much group A strep. So group A strep is covered with this M protein, which is like this fibrillar protein. Many people are working on the protein, the conserved region of that protein, to develop a vaccine, and a vaccine that's oral. I won't go into that with you. And so, and for those of you that remember, it's a hemolytic strep. It produces a lot of enzymes, hyaluronidases, DNAs, and so that when you get the organism proliferating, so for example, if you don't have antibody to the M protein and it starts proliferating, then you can elaborate all of these enzymes that destroy tissue and can move along fascial planes. In addition, it releases a toxin, and that toxin is what we call a super antigen. So it, rather than going through a macrophage or an APC cell, it actually can take the APC cell and take the lymphocyte and bind them like a key almost externally. And so that rather than getting specific lymphocyte activation, you get non-specific lymphocyte activation. And so with non-specific lymphocyte activation, you get cytokines, you get shock, and you get toxic shock syndrome, increased creatinine, increased LFTs, hypotension. And so when you see that in the setting of having a positive Gram stain or a positive blood culture, we know it's toxic shock syndrome secondary to gas, group A strep. You can also get toxic shock syndrome secondary to Staph aureus. So when I was a resident, again, talking about changing epidemiology, there were a lot of young women coming in with toxic shock syndrome secondary to Staph aureus, a very, very similar a toxin, but it's the Staph exotoxin. And those girls, do you remember what they had? Tampons, right. And so then you found out, you know, don't keep your tampons in too long, da-da-da, and that really changed the epidemiology of toxic shock syndrome. And now we see much more group A strep, again, changing epidemiologies. And so she had group A strep, and we're going to talk about therapy because I don't know where I put it. So not that I need the slide. I don't really need the slide, but I just want to show you the pictures. That's what she looked like. Those are bullas that have ruptured. And so I want to just spend a few minutes on you. You know, type 1, Unison, Clinda, Zosyn, it really depends on what we're targeting. I hate to give you it. I mean, you know what you're covering. I think that's really what you need to know. Because, you know, if somebody's been in the hospital in and out, and they have like an open decubitus ulcer, you're not giving them Unison and Clinda, you know. So it really depends on, I think it's better to know the syndromes and know what organisms cause them, and then, you know, look at your patient. Type 2, I did want to say this, though. I don't know if I have a slide in it, so I don't want to. Do I? Yeah, I do. Okay, so because I really think this is important for you to know, and we went over this in conference, but group A strep, when it's at a very large inoculum, like in the soft tissue, goes into stationary phase. And so back in the 1940s, Eagle's media was at Einstein, and he noticed that group A strep was not that sensitive in large inoculums to penicillin. And that really went fairly unnoticed until a group, Bisnow, Stevens, all looked at different models of group A strep. And one of the models was a mouse myositis model, which came out in the early 1990s. And they gave both groups of mice strep myositis, and one group they treated with Clinda, and one they treated with penicillin. And the Clinda group did so much better than the penicillin group. And so then a bunch of people did some experiments where they actually looked at the penicillin binding proteins and saw that they really weren't very well expressed in large inoculums of strep. And so all of that taken together, people give clindamycin. So you ask me, why do we care if it's a strep lymphangitis? I mean, I'm going to give gram-positive coverage anyway. Well, you're going to add Clinda in that setting. And I can tell you that I trained before the Clinda data and after the Clinda data, and Clinda is like, I always add Clinda because the difference in response is remarkable, really remarkable. Do I not give a beta-lactam? No, because there are no human studies, and there's a lot of human experience with beta-lactams in group A strep. So I'm not going to just drop my, so I give a beta-lactam, penicillin, cephalosporin, whatever I'm giving, and I give clindamycin when I really am suspicious of group A strep. And the other thing is that because Clinda acts on protein synthesis, maybe it also suppresses toxin reduction. Intravenous globulin. There is no fabulous data on intravenous globulin, and there are no clear recommendations. It neutralizes circulating strep toxin, and so if we think about it, that toxin is basically binding lymphocytes non-specifically. So if you bind up the toxin, you hopefully stop the shock. And so people have done this both in retrospective cases where they did retrospective studies. They compared patients treated with immunoglobulin to retrospective case controls and found that, you know, these were people that they thought would die and they didn't die. And there was a very small double-blinded placebo-controlled trial which shows that the patients that got intravenous globulin did better. Me personally, there are no clear recommendations. If I think somebody, if I've got a gram stain, a blood culture, I give immunoglobulin. So the lady you just saw in the picture got immunoglobulin. I've given immunoglobulin 3 times, but a neck fasciitis in my book gets immunoglobulin. It's interesting. There was a case where they were talking to me on the phone, and the patient had a lesion in the thigh that had a bulla in it, and the patient was hypotensive. And I told the ID fellow, this was when the immunoglobulin data was just out, and I had just been at a conference, and I said, tell them to add immunoglobulin. The patient was hypotensive. So the next day she said to me, the patient was hypotensive. They said they took the patient in the OR, they removed the lesion, and after they removed the lesion, you know, the infected part of the lesion, the patient's blood pressure went up, and I was like, well, that was my immunoglobulin. And they're like, oh, no, Dr. Coyle. They never gave the immunoglobulin. So really, you want to remove the infection, and that's what you really want to do. And it also goes to show you, if they'd given the immunoglobulin, I would be touting my great, you know, immunoglobulin case. So an N of one never makes a study. This is just to tell you about Clostridia perfringens, but I think we did that. So this is a young man that, young, 50, that's young to me, came to the emergency room with knee pain, and he had this ecchymosis on his leg, and they sent him out, and some of you saw this the last time I gave a lecture, and so he came back to our emergency room, And they did plane films, and you can see he's got gas. So we know it's not a group A strep. He's in a lot of pain. And so they took him to the emergency. They took him emergently to surgery, and he grew Clostridia septicum out of his blood. So you need to know that Clostridia septicum is associated with GI malignancies. I don't know if I told this story. I didn't tell it at the conference. But now you'll be as smart as I am. So I had seen this case. I knew nothing about Clostridia septicum. I read up on it. And then a number of years later, I was with the radiologist, and there was a lady with a breast infection that was just admitted, and she had air tracking into the mediastinum. And so they said to me, oh, you should go see the patient. And I said, oh, I know what she has. She has Clostridium septicum. So true story. And so they said, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. So the patient died because the ID attending also did not agree with me and grew Clostridium septicum out of the blood. And it was really just that air in a spontaneous soft tissue necrotizing fasciitis that made me know that it was because I had seen a case before. So normally fever, excruciating pain in an extremity, a lot of times people think it's either a deep vein thrombophlebitis or some other type of vascular thing. You should get films and you'll see crepitus or gas. And I have a lot of things here, but I won't do this because I've said it all. But, you know, these are other things that it's been associated with. But for us, we normally see it in the setting of colon carcinoma. I know it's late, and treatment is like any other Clostridium. Penicillin is not. You need to not take these slides. They have a lot of mistakes on them. So because penicillin is the drug of choice, and Phyllis didn't put that on there. This is from a book. This is a guy that, again, came with this pain, and you can see he's developing bulla, and he also had that on the soft tissue and ended up having Clostridia septicum. Do you want me to do this or no? It's late. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. You want me to just do one case, though? Do you have 2 minutes? Oh, my God, they're exhausted. Look at some of them look like they... Some of them look like... You look like you need, like, a Foley, and you need to be tubed. Okay. So I just want to... orbital cellulitis is important, and I just want to go over something that was mentioned earlier. Predisposing factors for orbital cellulitis, obviously sinusitis, ophthalmic surgery, trauma. The clinical manifestations are ptosis, but you need to really be concerned when there's limitation of eye movement and double vision or visual loss. Visual loss should make you hysterical, and I mean that. And it's so amazing to me when I see cases and I'm hysterical and nobody else is hysterical. I'm like, okay, how could they not be hysterical? So the only good thing is that Carol Harris gets as hysterical as I do, because we see cases and we're always like amazed. So orbital apex involvement, that means that the nerve is the artery and the nerve at the apex are getting entrapped. And so this is a rapidly expanding posterior infection. That's what it's telling you. That means you need opto in there immediately, and it's a surgical emergency. Just so you know, orbital cellulitis is normally staph aureus and all of your other sinus pathogens, because normally that's the way one gets it, unless, of course, you've had surgery or some type of trauma, and that's a whole different kettle of fish. And predisposing factors are everything that I just told you, and I just want to show you. This is somebody with orbital cellulitis who presented while on the medical service. She said she had pain in her eye and swelling, and so the intern gave her, this is a true story, Motrin. And so then the next day he gave her Motrin. He never, like, then it closed. He never, like, opened her eye. So finally when he did open her eye, true story, it didn't look so good. Right. So you want to really, remember, we want to look up the leg. We also want to look in the eye. And so this patient actually had a strep A galactia infection from a bacteremia and had an orbital panendophthalmitis, all right? So remember that patients can also seed the eye from staph aureus, from group B strep, from group A strep. And this is a patient which is diabetic, who came in, and a non-acidemic patient who came in with an orbital cellulitis. And so he was given ceftriaxone and vanco in the emergency room, and the next day, there's his ptosis, And you can see he's actually got, and the night before he had full range of motion of his muscles and he had full visual feels. So now today you can see that he's got a lateral muscles are involved and they're not moving, and he also has decreased visual acuity. I was told by Optho, and so was Dr. Harris, that we were crazy to get so excited and continue our antibiotics. And so I was not the ID attending. This is him. This is him. So the ID fellow didn't see him on a Saturday and Sunday and just wrote a note saying patient doing well. And so then the patient presented the patient on a Monday to morning report and said he was now obtunded and now his other eye is developing proptosis and is also frozen. So what's the diagnosis? He actually had clear sinuses, by the way. What? What? Did someone say it? Mucor, right, mucormycosis. So you really need to think about mucormycosis in a diabetic. Once it goes to the other eye, you know the cavernous sinus is involved. This is the actual, this is not from the web. This is when Carol Harris herself went in and scraped inside the nose, all right, because nobody else would come, and that's why you really can't use this tape. But and you can see all the mucor in the nose of this patient. This was at post. This was all the way extending back. And so normally associated with hyperglycemia, and it's normally associated with an acute sinusitis that becomes a pansinusitis that goes to the palate. And so that's why the ENT people kept on saying it wasn't mucor, because the sinuses weren't involved. And so just remember, when you have a rapidly expanding infection like that in a diabetic, that might be me. That's me. Someone telling me I have to be somewhere. That's me. Orbital cellulitis, periorbital edema, proptosis, and blindness. So that's a lot of soft tissue. And to be frank with you, there's more. I didn't do pyomyositis, but I just didn't have enough time, and I don't think you could have handled it. I'm looking at you. You're like, I hate this woman. So that's it.